Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about Tidelift, a new way to get funded for your open source project. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 504, recorded October 31st, 2018. Tidelift. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, a podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe where you get your podcasts and visit redhat.com/heroes today. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and totally unaware of it, projects you might want to play with right after this show, or projects you might want to investigate right after this show. I think today is going to be one of those. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Jonathan Bennett. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Randall, it's good to be here once again.
It's been so long since you've been on. All of like exactly a week or so. It's 5 days.
Not even a week, right? That was part of the problem last week, is it was on a Friday and I wasn't ready for it. Yes.
yeah, all crazy stuff. And I am still in my same place. I am at my home in the western suburb of Portland, Oregon. And I will be here for another few days, and then I'll be back on the road again. I'm very happy to have been home after a nice 28-day road trip. It's kind of nice sleeping in my own bed for a little while, or whatever appears to be my bed anyway. This week we have an interesting project on. Let me look at my notes here. It's called Tidelift. And Tidelift gives maintainers and core teams a way to get paid for doing the work they love. Tidelift provides the tools and audience necessary for them to deliver a professional software experience. And we're going to have Louis Villa on in just a few minutes to talk about that. But from what I can understand from reading the website, it looks like they have found yet another funding model for providing for open source. I know we're always talking about, as we talk to these various projects over the last 10 years, we've been saying, well, how are you doing this? Is this a labor of love? Is this something that you're selling commercial support for? Is this something where you have a freemium model? You know, we've enumerated many, many ways of doing this sorts of things. Maybe you're getting paid by a foundation or something, and so on. But it looks like Tidelift has found yet another way to do this. From what I understand, and of course, Louis will clear us up if we get something a little bit wrong there, is it looks like if I'm a user of open source and I want to make sure that the open source I use sticks around, Tidelift looks at all the current licenses that I'm currently using and goes out to those projects and works out a subscription rate. So in other words, I would pay a monthly fee into Tidelift. Tidelift takes a slight cut and then proportions the money coming in for those projects out to the projects that people are using in an appropriate, proportionate sort of way. And I think that's a sort of interesting thing. It's Wired Magazine actually called it the Netflix of open source. In other words, you pay one flat fee, and then as you use the various materials, the various vendors get paid for their subscription. So what do you know about this so far, Jonathan?
Not a whole lot more than you mentioned, although I do have some questions about it. Obviously, one of the first things is it a play on the old adage that a rising tide lifts all boats? And I suspect that's where the name came from. And then one of the other things I'm very interested in is, do they do anything with assurance? So, you know, how deeply are they looking into the software that they are helping people subscribe to? You know, are they doing things like letting folks know, hey, this version has a bug in it, you need to make sure an update? Do they provide that kind of, I guess we could call it a value-added service? So I'm very interested to learn more about this as well.
Cool. Well, before we bring on Louis Villa, we do have an important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, an original podcast for geeks, by geeks, from Red Hat. Command Line Heroes is dedicated to telling the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape. What is a Command Line Hero? You might be one if you've ever taken something apart to see how it works, or you'd rather make your own. Command Line Heroes are the makers, builders, dreamers, and doers who are transforming tech and shaping our tomorrows. Season 2 is all about living on the command line and tracking the changes that shape the world of open source development. They're discovering the origins of programming languages, mastering the art of making a pull request, learning about supercomputers, hybrid clouds, and more. Command Line Heroes is produced by Red Hat, an open source company that started in an apartment 25 years ago and knows a thing or two about where tech came from and where it is going. Season 2 is also hosted by Saran Yatbarak, a developer who founded Code Newbie, hosts two other tech podcasts, and lives and breathes open source software. They're taking Season 2 to great heights and beyond. Episode 1 launched on September 11th, so visit redhat.com/heroes to check it out today. Subscribe to Command Line Heroes wherever you get your podcasts, and visit redhat.com/heroes for extras and to learn more. That's redhat.com/heroes. And we thank Red Hat for their sponsorship of Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Louis Villa. Welcome. No, I said that backwards. Louis Villa, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
I knew I was going to blow that once. And if you're watching the video, which a small portion of our audience actually does, including the live audience, you might notice that Louis is not moving around very much. We had some bandwidth issues bringing him on the show, so we're using a still picture of him for the entire show just to make sure the audio, which is the most important, is actually clean. So, Louis, give us a 30,000-foot view. What problem is TideLift trying to solve, and how close did I get that?
You know, I think you got it pretty good. It is, in fact, about a rising tide lifting all boats, right? What we've seen is that in a world that is so complicated, where even a hello world gets 500, 700 libraries pulled in, you really need a solution that covers the entire stack, that gives you assurances about every piece of what's going on. And so that's what we've been trying to build, is something that allows people to subscribe once, have one set of contract negotiations, one set of dealings, and then we go out and find those 500, 700, 1500 maintainers and work with them to make sure the quality of the software remains high, both today and in the future.
Well, there have already been a number of funding models in this area, as I mentioned at the opening of the show. So, I mean, how is this different from, say, just being a foundation?
So I think the key thing is that it's Wired called us the Netflix of open source, and I don't know that that's quite right. But the key thing there is that it is money goes out to everyone, right? If you are it used to be when I started in this, and I know when you started in this, Randall, the number of dependencies you had when you were building, say, a web app was pretty low, right? You had your operating, the core operating system. You'd pick a database. You'd pick a language stack, maybe a handful of libraries, right? So it was feasible for you to, if you wanted to get support for your entire stack, you could go and talk to 5-10 people, give money to a handful of foundations or a handful of companies. And, that was something you could do as part of your business. It's not possible anymore to do that, right? You can't just give, there's no one foundation or one for-profit that you can give to and have assurances about your entire stack. And so what we want to do is solve that problem, right? Make it so that there is one place you can go and get coverage for an increasing, ever-increasing amount of your stack.
So go ahead.
Oh, so I was just going to draw back to that Netflix thing, right? Netflix, you pay one check and all of the creators get money. And that's what we're trying to, that's analogous to what we're trying to do, right? One check and all the developers who you interact with get money based on how many of our users are using their product.
So let's say I'm a business owner and I want to get protection and maintenance for the stack that I'm using with all the 150, 400, 6,000 components, whatever it happens to be. Do I then approach TideLift and say, I want to become a customer of yours and you determine some sort of monetary level that I need to participate at based on the things that are in my stack?
Yeah, so we have we have some standard pricing based mostly on the number of teams you have using the product. And then we go out, we scan what your teams are doing, and we go out and identify those projects. And in early days, we go out and directly contact those projects and we say, hey, we have customers who are using your stuff. If you agree to provide certain assurances, then we'll agree to pay you based on the number of customers we have using it. Right. Over time, of course, we won't have to do that as much because we'll have already made contact with a lot of the biggest developers.
Now, am I going to be paying? My follow-up question then is am I going to be paying based on everything I'm using, or am I going to be able to select, say, here's the critical components for my enterprise? Can I just do a tide lift agreement on those?
You know, we really think it's important to do a subscription on everything, right? Because, frankly, our experience, you know, you've seen this as well, everyone in the space has seen it, is that there are packages that tend to get forgotten about, right? Nobody thinks about the OpenSSLs or the left paths of the world until they're broken. And so we really think that by having a way to support the entire stack, that's going to come out with the best outcomes for everybody, right? You'll have not just that one or two things that are high profile, top of mind every day, but you also have assurance about all the rest of it. And we think that's important both for if you're a business, that's actually what's going to give you the best outcomes long term. And obviously, if you're an open source developer, that is what we think is going to have the best outcomes for the whole ecosystem, right? If we were, we don't want to just be the solutions for the handful of projects that are popular, that everybody knows their name, but rather the solution for everybody else as well.
Hey, Lewis, it's Jonathan Bennett. I wanted to jump in and ask a couple of questions. So we've talked about assurance for software, and this is something that's on my mind. In fact, in the last couple of days, I finished writing an article for Hackaday about this. There was a fairly popular library called Colorama that basically what it did is it allowed doing Unix style text colors in the Windows terminal. It's a Python package. And color in Colorama was spelled in the American way. And somebody decided to start a new project, Colorama, but spelling color in the British way. And they added a little bit of malware inside of this package. And I'm curious, is trying to catch things like that part of the assurance that Tidelift offers to customers?
It's definitely on our roadmap. One of the things that we think we can do, because we have a direct relationship with all of the developers, is we can do things like track and make sure that the release is actually made by the person you think it's made by, right? And we can flag, hey, this changed maintainership and we don't know why. You should consider looking at something else. I mean, more basically, we're looking at things like project health, right? So, for example, we know that one of the sort of leading indicators for whether or not a package is going to get malwared like this is whether or not it's been unmaintained for a long time, right? We found a package just the other day for a customer who it turns out something had been unmaintained for 4 years and there was some lack of clarity about the licensing and there was a replacement that's much more actively maintained and we were able to point them at that, right? You know, that's the kind of, we're not targeting the malware case specifically yet, but by having those relationships, we think we can do that in the future and it's definitely on our radar.
Sure. One of the conclusions I came to when looking at this subject is, really, the key is maintainers like in Debian and in Fedora. You've got these guys that, very similar to what you're describing, have relationships with the projects. They know them. They know the people that's developing them. I think it's interesting that you guys kind of sit in the same space. You've got that same opportunity that once you meet people, you have their email addresses, you can maybe even call them up on the phone, it puts you in a place to be able to say, we know that this package is what it says it is. I think that's great.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I think it's worth saying, right, that this goes beyond just call them on the phone. We have a contractual relationship with them. Now, I'm a former programmer, now a lawyer, so I'm maybe a little prone to overemphasizing the like that kind of thing, right? But I think it's important to, you know, we're actually paying them. We're not just asking nicely. And, you know, that's an important part of how we assure our customers that this is real, right? It's not just folks on the internet being nice to you. Like, folks on the internet being nice to you has been amazing, right? We've all seen, those of us who've been involved for a long time, we've all seen how that has changed the world, right? But if you're a business building everything around open source, and these days all software businesses build everything around open source, it's going to help you sleep a little bit better at night if the relationship is something stronger.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to that and ask you more about that in just a second. But first, do you guys do things also like track CVEs and then notify your customers when, hey, there is a really important patch you need to pull or an update you need to grab?
So we do track CVEs, but I think even more importantly, we actually encourage maintainers to give us very specific information on things like what versions do the CVEs apply to? And are there things that didn't rise to the level of being a CVE, but you still think were a security vulnerability of some sort? Right. And we can get very, because we're working directly with the maintainers, we can get very granular on that. So we can give you much more detailed information about security vulnerabilities for the packages that the maintainers have signed up for. Right. And that's part of the, you know, that's part of that relationship that we have with them, where we are asking maintainers to go a little bit further, right, to do some stuff that, frankly, there's not necessarily public standards for, and there's not necessarily motivation for, right? You know, I don't think it's a knock on the average open source maintainer to say that they're typically focused on, like, what's the latest release? How do I support that latest release? And they're not necessarily thinking too much, and they often, frankly, don't have a lot of data about who's using the older stuff. When did people start using it? When did people stop using it? And we can make that information flow both ways, right? We can say, we can tell one of our subscribers, hey, the maintainer told us this version you're on, nobody should use it, right? And on the flip side, we can tell maintainers, we can say, hey, you know what? It turns out of your users, 70% of them are still using this old version. Maybe you care about it a little bit more than you used to, than you think you did.
Yeah. So what does it look like when you approach a project? I assume you approach a project, or does it go the other way around? Projects come to you. That kind of initial, I assume there's a negotiation of some sort about, you know, the relationship that's going to happen. Sounds like a contract is signed. What does that look like?
Sure. So that goes both ways. So we do have. One person on my team whose job it is to go around and tell high profile projects, hey, you know what? You can get paid if you sign up to our core obligations. And so we're definitely doing a bit of, it's sort of funny. We were discussing what to call my team originally, because I'm both the company's lawyer and co-founder, but I also run, what we call a lifter engagement and success, right? With the idea being, lifters are the folks who lift the packages. That's what we call maintainers internally. And, you know, I used to run the community team at the Wikimedia Foundation, and that was very clearly a community, right? It was a bunch of volunteers editing Wikipedia articles. Mm-hmm. We definitely have some of that aspect here, but we have a sales aspect as well, right? We're going out, especially in early days, we're going out and telling people that they can join up, sign up, and get paid. But we also have, we announced about a month ago now that we're paying out, we've committed to paying out $1 million to maintainers and of top projects. And so some people are finding us through that as well, right? They're finding us you can go to our website. If you're a maintainer, you can go to our website, search for your packages, anything that you maintain, and sign up to talk to us and get into a relationship. If it's a very popular package, we might pay you immediately. If it's a less popular package, we will work with you to inform your inform your users that they can become Tidelift subscribers, and then you'll get paid once they sign up. So I think that, you were asking about the, like, what's that contact? So that was the, how do we contact people, right? We have both sales and people coming in. On the flip side, like, once that is made, basically it's a explanatory process, right? We tell you, hey, here's how our business model works. Here's the commitments you're going to make, right? Which are, as we've already sort of discussed, there's some things about security, some things about licensing. And, you know, those are sort of the key things right now that we expect to grow that over time. So we explain to you what those obligations are, and you say, hey, sounds great. We send you I keep saying a contract, but, you know, it's 2018, right? We're not going to make you fire up a fax machine or anything. You know, it's all online, but it is, you know, we do like to keep it a little bit formal. It's not just a click through to really, make sure that people know that this is real, right? This is both something they're getting paid for, but also a commitment.
Sure. We do have a couple of questions from the chat room. The first one I'll ask you is, not forget to floss wants to know, is this only for software that runs locally, or could it be used for things like WordPress plugins and other add-on type software?
It can be used for, well, the key thing is that right now it needs to be package managed. Right. So we operate as a service to the community, a project called libraries.io, which tracks, I think at last count, 37 or 38 different package managers, because we use dependency data to figure out what packages are most popular, what's most widely used. So as long as it's package managed in one of those top, I mean, I think we even get down to like the Emacs package manager, but obviously the most popular ones are things like Node and therefore NPM. So as long as you're in one of those, sure, the model applies. And at least conceptually, if there's other things the libraries.io doesn't support yet, we could support that.
Sure. And then the second question from the chat room so far is from Emily the Strange, a frequent listener and question asker. So what happens in the worst case scenario, like when a developer stops updating their packages for security, but doesn't tell anyone, and a big security flaw is found and exploited? Do customers have legal rights to anything?
That's a great question. The key thing is we think the way to solve that problem is actually proactively. Right. We think that you should be finding out. Unfortunately, the reality is these days, the current status quo is that you often find out about a package going unmaintained exactly by finding out that, you know, there was an exploit in it. Right. We would like to surface to people, hey, you know what? This is unmaintained. And so, therefore, we think in the long run, it's likely to be a problem, right? You should switch to, we can use our data to show, hey, other people have switched away from this package because it was unmaintained to this other thing that provides similar functionality. So we think that's the right answer to that question is fix it before it comes up, right? Don't have the security vulnerability in the first place because you're not using unmaintained packages. Sure. Past that, we can't, at least as it's currently structured, we can't go back in time. Oh, I should say, I guess the other key thing, of course, is that if somebody was a lifter, stopped maintaining the package, we'd stop paying them. Right. And so they have an incentive to continue to maintain it. And on the flip side, you as a subscriber to us have some sense of security that, hey, this thing is real. Somebody's still paying attention to it. So, but we can't, if somebody has dropped off the face of the planet, it's hard for us to go back in time and take that money back, or, we don't want to be running around suing lifters, right? Like that's not a winning game for anybody. So we'd much prefer to use our data to help proactively solve these problems.
Sure.
Because we can definitely, if somebody has stopped taking a check from us, we can definitely let people know, right? We can say, hey, you know what? This person has gone on to a different line of work. They're not engaged anymore. You should look into your options.
Sure. How do you define a package or a program, a project that is, that's that's now unmaintained. And I ask this because there are some projects that are out there that haven't seen a release in, you know, a couple of years, but there's still a community around it, and there's still somebody there that has the commit rights to it. And if there was a big problem found, they'd jump into action right away. But just because of the problem that it solves, it's kind of static. You know, there are some of these old projects that just they haven't had any code committed for a couple of years because, you know, in one way or another, the problem they're there to fix is fixed. It's done.
Right.
And how does that interact with this idea of being maintained or unmaintained?
Well, so, I mean, one simple flag for us, and the most obvious one is that maintainer still in touch with us, right? So this is, again, a thing that you can distinguish between sort of the common case as it was before Tidelift and what it could be like in a world where Tidelift is really successful is, you know, simply, hey, are they still checking in with us monthly? Are they still receiving and cashing our checks? Like, that's one way to know if something is maintained that in the Tidelift system you can have in the Tidelift system and you can't have otherwise. The other big and obvious thing is that we're actually, I'm surprised at how much we've seen this come up. It wasn't something that I would have anticipated when we first got involved or when we first started this. Is how often these things that everybody thinks are done break for upgrades of their own dependencies, right? So, like, think of how many Python 2 libraries that are done, right? The problem that the Python library has tackled has been solved, but hasn't necessarily been upgraded to Python 3, right? Or, I was talking with one of our lifters. One of our lifters lifts a testing framework. And they consider the project pretty much done and have for years. But yet every time there's a new release of the underlying framework that they're testing, they have to sort of frantically scramble to make sure that the thing still works, right? And 9 times out of 10, there's no new release, but they've done work behind the scenes. So that's another marker. That's another flag there. I mean, past that, it's still a work in progress, right? Like, this question is not an easy one, but we think we've got some ideas that we'll continue to work on and continue to develop there.
Well, I'm happy to be, I'm a little disappointed. I went to libraries.io looking for the 5 or 6 things I've contributed to the CBAN, and I don't see any of them listed there. So there must be some higher threshold than just simply having been published on the CBAN. And one of those, in fact, was something that you were alluding to a few minutes ago, or at least Jonathan was, that CGI prototype, which I wrote almost a decade and a half ago and put it up on the CPAN, was still in active use at its primary client, University at Buffalo, for many, many years after I made any changes to it. It's just because the code was good. It worked. And it's in current use by insightcruises.com for their back-end staff. And again, I've made no changes to the code because the code just works the way we wanted it to. And so there hasn't been a release on the CPAN for a decade. And people think, well, the project's dead. No, it's not. It's just I won't say it's perfect, but it works. It works. It works well enough so that people are still using it. So that's the important part. And it actually held up well over time. I had the advantage of having already been a professional programmer for 20 years before I wrote it, so I had a pretty good sense of the pitfalls I could see in a general framework like that. My file finder, which is also in the CPAN, also isn't listed in your listing. It actually doesn't run on Windows. I never had a Windows box. I never tested on that, but I get these bug reports about every 3 weeks from the CPAN testers saying it still doesn't work on Windows. And I go, of course, I know it still doesn't work on Windows. I haven't changed it to fix that. I don't care about Windows.
At that point out, actually, one of the things that we can also monitor and that we do monitor is simply interaction, right? Like, as long as it's in a public forum, we can say, hey, one of the things we know about this is that the maintainer is still interacting with users, even if they haven't done a new release, right? We don't currently have any We don't force maintainers to do that, right? That's not part of the deal right now. But, you know, it's another thing that we can monitor and look at. And, we still don't have, like I said, we still don't have firm rules because we're still pretty new. But that's something that we can think about in the future. I'm surprised about CPAN. I want to get the names of those things afterwards because we do have, I think it's 3 million packages in libraries.io these days. So I'm really surprised to hear that something from CPAN isn't in there. It should be comprehensive. And if it's not, that's a bug. I want to talk to you about it afterwards.
Absolutely. Wonderful. And because when I type in File Finder, I actually found the three or four packages that reference it as some alternative to themselves. So I know I know it has the right era there, but it doesn't have File Finder. So it's like, and I'm pretty proud about File Finder. That's one of my favorite things that I created. So let's talk about this again from the perspective of being a lifter. So I have a contract with you, with Tidelift, and am I getting paid based on the number of people that subscribe that include me as one of their participants?
That includes you as one of their dependencies, right? So they don't even, again, to get back to this big difference from, when you and I started doing this to now is that, or even from 5-10 years ago to now, it used to be it wasn't a crazy suggestion to say, I have to manually check every one of my dependencies to understand what they are, right? Mm-hmm. Even, like I said, even 5-10 years ago, like that was starting to get difficult, but it wasn't obviously wrong to request that. Now it would just be if I were still a lawyer in private practice and I went into a client and said, your engineers have to know exactly who the maintainer is of every single dependency that they use, I'd be laughed out of the place, right?
Right.
And so instead, what we're doing is a dependency scan of the stuff that you say you're using. We'll do that dependency scan, and then we pay people based on, right now the formula is an interaction of what are our subscribers using, what's in their dependency tree, and to some extent the size of the package, right? So if you're doing something like LeftPad that is really widely used, but LeftPad is a node package that I think was 10 lines and somebody deleted a few years ago, causing some a great mess in that community.
Yes, over the internet.
Yeah. So we do an interaction of essentially the size of the package with the usage, right? So if everybody uses it, but it's small, you get paid some. If everybody uses it and it's, React, so it's huge, then that gets paid differently. We do some, we're still working on exactly how we do this, but we do then do some filtering for things like, for example, we ran into a package the other day that's essentially just all of Unicode packaged in a Python dependency, right? And so the actual the actual work that went into that is very small, but the package is huge because Unicode is huge, right? So we do some manual checking of that kind of thing. But it's basically that interaction of popularity amongst our paid subscribers. What are they actually depending on? And the size. There's a blog post up on our site that if we want to share some links later, explain some of that, I think.
Sure. We'll share whatever we got sent before the show in the show notes for sure. So now I went on a total blank. I was trying to figure out, so you're auditing the licenses, the code, the dependencies that you're using. Are you using an off-the-shelf tool for that, or did you write something for yourself?
We're using a mix of some off-the-shelf tools and some stuff we're writing for ourselves. The interesting thing that we're doing is we're actually starting from the flip side. Most of the off-the-shelf tools for license scanning are extremely fine-grained, right? They are literally looking at like every single file header in a package. And that leads to, if you've ever had a client do a license scan and been forced to deal with the results, that leads to thousands of false positives, right? And we didn't think that was very useful. And so what we've been doing instead is actually looking at the simplest information about licensing that we can find. So my favorite example of this is most package managers these days have a license metadata field. And GitHub also will try to detect license information automatically. So we simply compare those two. And if your package manager and GitHub disagree, that's a warning flag that other things may be wrong in the licensing, right? But that's like the simplest possible licensing metadata that we could get. It turns out that depending on how you want to look at it, somewhere between 10 and 20% of packages don't even get that most basic level right. And so, you know, we're starting with those kinds of simple tests to help nudge developers and lifters in the right direction, right? And you'd be surprised, you know, people, they run that test and they're like, turns out I had just said BSD and hadn't really specified what kind of BSD license, right? Or I had specified GPL, but I hadn't specified what version. And so, you know, we think that that's sort of the first level of a community-friendly, bottom-up kind of way of approaching licensing, because this, the approach that big companies take is not, it's not very scalable, frankly.
Is your license auditing software and dependency auditing software, I should say, something that I could run in private against my code base if I have privacy concerns?
If you're a paying customer, yes.
Ah, good. I was worried about that. I was thinking, okay, are you coming in and seeing my entire, you know, proprietary code base just so you can figure out what dependencies I have? And that would be something I don't think many operational managers would allow.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's definitely – actually, let me take a step back and answer that, right? Because I think it actually says something pretty important about who we are as a company. Okay. So all of the four co-founders have been doing – this, and by this I mean not just open source, but enterprise level open source for getting on two decades now, right? So Donald, one of my co-founders and our CEO, was the first product manager for Red Hat Enterprise Linux, and has since then gone on to invest in a bunch of open source companies. And you know, similarly, one of my other co-founders, Jeremy Katz, among other things, he maintained the Red Hat Package Manager, RPM, for many years, has since worked at HubSpot and Google and a bunch of other companies. So we are, you could say positively, you could say we're battle scarred. You know, we understand all these things it takes to sell into big enterprise companies. The one you just mentioned is a great example of that, right? There's all kinds of security concerns. There's all kinds of privacy concerns. And that's the kind of thing, frankly, that we want to take off the hands of the average open source maintainer. Because you can learn that the hard way by trying to sell support for your one library into a bunch of companies, which, as you know from experience, that's not easy to do. Or you can offload that sales job to us. We can figure that part out. We can let you know, hey, you know what? It turns out big enterprises care about X, Y, and Z. So you just take care of X, Y, and Z, and we'll take care of sales and all that kind of other stuff, right? We'll take care of figuring out, how do you know if somebody is using your package internally? And that's really what we think is a big part of the value for lifters, is that you can get paid, but still focus much closer to the things that you actually care about, which probably is not enterprise sales.
Hey, Lewis, I wanted to ask, we've talked a lot about the relationship that you have with your customers and the relationship that you forge with developers. What about with these repositories? Do you guys have contact with, relationships with places like NPM and PyPy?
You know, we've talked to them. I mean, nothing deep yet. We're not doing, I think, anything particularly rocket science-y with that dependency information. So we haven't needed to have deep conversations with them. But, you know, we're certainly not if any folks from those projects are listening to us, today, we'd certainly be happy to talk to you. We're definitely talking with some related projects and foundations who do support some of that core infrastructure, and so we'd be happy to continue those conversations.
Sure. So we had a follow-up question from Emily the Strange. She says she's going to piggyback on her own question. What's the liability for if you recommend something to your clients to upgrade to a new software update, but it ends up really messing up the client system or network? Who's responsible at that point? And I guess that's kind of a follow-up question about this idea of assurance and the kind of assurance that you give to customers.
Right. Well, asking a lawyer about legal liability, I mean, how much time do we have left?
Not enough.
And so, right. So I won't get into that in that much detail. We have to give, as you know, and as I'm sure Emily knows, because she's asking intelligent questions here, this is, software is as much art as science, right? And so at some level, so we give customers the control to say, hey, you know what? We know this is outdated. We know this is unmaintained, but we've done that evaluation and we're going to suck it up and let it go, right? So please just don't warn us about this one in the future because we know, right? Likewise, we can't evaluate all the code, right? We can't. If you've got a big complicated system, we can tell you you should think about it, but we ultimately can't be the ones who evaluate that and decide whether or not it makes sense for you specifically. All we can do is surface information that you might not have had otherwise so that you can make a more informed decision yourself. Because our observation these days is that a lot of folks end up sort of flying blind on this, right? Like they're part of why they stick with older libraries is because they don't know enough about the new versions, so it's hard for them to make decisions. And we think we can supplement that, but ultimately we can't make the decision ourselves.
So to go in a bit of a different direction, if you've got a customer that's running on a Red Hat system, do you pull information from Yum or someone on a Debian system? Do you pull information from apt? Is that are those some of the repositories you connect to?
So we don't do C libraries yet. I shouldn't just say C libraries. I mean, the sort of core operating system libraries, and we don't for a couple reasons, right? One is simply that there's a variety of different package managers instead of one central one. Like, libc is going to be in both. It's changed names so many times now. DNF, I guess, is the Red Hat one these days. And, apt on the Debian side. Plus all of, as you know, a lot of the Docker images these days are all in Alpine. So there's a whole different set of things there. So we haven't really, we haven't gone that deep in the stack for that technical reason. There's also simply the social reason that that's the best supported part of the stack already, right? It's not perfect as the OpenSSL situation shows us, but there are so many companies and sources of revenue and infrastructure there that it's different from from that sort of mid-tier, right? Like the stuff that's in NPM, the stuff that's in CPAN or PyPI, those should all be, those are where we think there's the biggest weakness, the biggest gap to be filled.
It certainly makes sense. That's kind of the observation that I've made as well, because you don't have maintainers for those repositories. And then a follow-up question, which doesn't quite make as much sense because of your answer, but I think it's still worth asking. How do you differentiate between what is installed and what is actually used? So the context I was thinking of is, on my Linux box, I've got thousands of packages and probably a good quarter of them never get called, they're just not used. I would assume that you have something similar in in these kind of middleware repositories where while doing development, a bunch of packages get installed and maybe aren't part of the end code. Do you have something in place to be able to determine how often something is being used as a part of the end project?
That's definitely on our to-do list. Let me tell you a sort of funny, silly story about that. So I used to, when I was a lawyer in private practice, one of the things that I did was help customers with their GPL compliance, right? So mm-hmm. if you were, if you were shipping an Android device or, like my TV has Linux in it these days, right? Mm-hmm. You would come to my law firm and you'd say, hey, we want to make sure that we're doing all the right things under the GPL. Here's a list of the software we're shipping. And you know what software they almost always said was on these devices?
What's that?
GDB, the debugger, right? And I'd sit there as their lawyer and be like, I don't know exactly what's on your device because I don't have it in front of me right now. But I'm pretty sure you do not have GDB shipping on this device, right?
And if you do, I'm pretty sure that's a problem.
If you do, yeah. If you do, that's probably a mistake. Again, I'm just your lawyer. But that is a very common and very real problem. I think there's a couple things that mitigate it a little bit, right? So one is, I think that there's, in the sort of modern package managed languages, people are getting a little bit better, like the average practice is a little bit better than it used to be about distinguishing like what's on my test machines, like what's in my build environment versus what's in my actual deployed environment. So that is less of a problem than it used to be, right? Because of course, all these embedded devices that I was dealing with in my private legal practice, those were all, there wasn't a sort of standard repository, a standard set of tools. So people were, part of why they were confused is they were doing this all by hand, right? And they were sort of figuring it out as they went. And that's less common. And we think it's going to become even less common over time, right? Like the pace of development is increasing. And that means automation is also increasing along with it. So right now, what we scan is really what your build tools pull in, right? Mm-hmm. If it's not listed in your build tool, it's not showing up in our scans currently. So that's not perfectly accurate. There's definitely gaps, things we, both false positives and false negatives. But as a first approximation, that's, we've been finding that it's good enough to really help subscribers feel like they've made a big improvement, and of course to help identify the key lifters.
Mm. Well, Lewis, good news. You and Jonathan were talking, I was able to actually find both CGI Prototype and File Finder, so they're both in there. So I just wasn't using the right way of searching in the keywords and stuff for that. CGI Prototype was created in a very cold winter in December 1st, 2004 at the university at Buffalo. Buffalo, New York is not a good place to be in December. I remember building it there and I was like, oh, I'm freezing every day. Most recent release was 2011, probably an update for CGIPM changing. So that's been changed. And File Finder was initially created in 2003. And I haven't touched it since 2005, not even to fix the Windows problem, but they're both in there. So I'm pretty happy that you don't have a gap in your coverage of at least the CPAN. So that's those are two more obscure packages.
I'm glad we don't have a gap in the coverage. I'm still frustrated about there's a user experience problem there. If you weren't finding it, we should be helping the search to work better. So
Typing the lowercase package name because that's how it typically shows up in package managers. I was typing file-finder all lowercase, but as soon as I typed capital F in File Finder, it found it. So there's a case sensitivity issue for that. So that was interesting. So
it'll be a lot of CPU cycles to make this stuff case insensitive, but I think we can maybe manage in 2018 to to make sure it's case insensitive.
We're almost out of time, but I do have one other area I wanted to cover as well. How is your support for containers and container building systems?
What we're looking at is the build system of the code that's running within it, right? So there's still, it's definitely on our to-do list because for obvious reasons, containers are huge. But we would, like, if you're running, like, the most common case in our experience with our customers so far is they're doing something like Alpine Linux, like a base image, right? And then they're running something like npm install to build out the node packages that are in the image, for example, right? So we would cache the things that is being installed through npm, but not necessarily that underlying Alpine level, right? So, so the more standardized your build process is, the better we're going to be at catching it. Again, it's not perfect, but in part by spreading this out across many different customers, a thing that's sort of, how to put it, probabilistically correct, right? Like we don't have to, if we have 100 customers or 1,000 customers and our scan is incorrect on one of them, it's not going to make that big of a difference to the results for the lifter one way or the other. Because if you're still used by the other 999, you're going to make a lot of money. And if that's the only customer you're used by, that one scan that was missed, then you weren't going to make that much money anyway. So
sure.
That makes
sense. So we're almost out of time. Is there anything we didn't ask you that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before we have to let you go?
You know, I think the one thing that we haven't really touched on is the frustration that a lot of developers feel right now about making a career out of this, right? We've talked a lot about the technical things. How is this going to get scanned? How is this going to get picked up? How's the money allocated?
Right.
What we keep hearing when we talk to developers is, I know so many people are making value out of my open source, and it's hard for me to build a life out of it, right? And so I do these other things that allow me to do open source on the weekends. And we hope, you know, the reason we founded the company is we think it'd be better for both big enterprises and for the developers if the developers were able to say, you know what, actually, this is my job, right? This thing that I'm passionate about, or maybe, you know, in the case of somebody like you who's been doing it for a while, Randall, many different things have added up over time into something that I can make a career out of. And that sort of emotional component is something that we hear every day. And we really hope that we've built something here that can help fix that gap, right? Because there should be something between Red Hat IPO'd, it didn't IPO, Red Hat got sold for $30-some billion. And I'm sort of scraping along on weekends to do this for fun, right? There's got to be something in between, we think. And we hope that this is that model. You know, and that emotional gap is as important to us as any of the technical details.
Yeah, and I'm lucky because early in my career, I decided to go all in on open source and figure out a way to constantly make money doing it via consulting and writing and teaching and things like that. And I had the wherewithal to do all that. But a lot of people aren't able to make that jump from, you know, doing this on nights and weekends because I like to do it, versus, you know, actually building a business around it. Or maybe they can't because they've got a day job and that gets in their way. So day job disappeared just before that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you had started, you know, you obviously, like, you know, I mean, I owned one of your books many, many moons ago. It's been a long time since I wrote any Perl, but, you know, and we think if there was somebody like you coming along today, we would be one of the core building blocks of that, right? You might still do consulting. We certainly don't prohibit, like, being a lifter is not exclusive to other things. If you want to still do writing and consulting and all those things, great. But lifting through Tidelift would be a complementary thing that would help you have the confidence to take that plunge. That's really important to us, and hopefully we'll see a lot more of that in the future. So if any of your listeners are interested, you know where to find us.
Absolutely. And one more last question. Well, a couple questions after that, because my audience will yell at me if I don't ask them. So, but one last question, sort of a follow-up to that. The formula for Tidelift isn't all that unique. Do you expect competition, and do you welcome it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we absolutely welcome it. I'm not sure that I expect the competition, right? There's a pretty unique blend of enterprise experience, enterprise sales experience, and the connection with users that I think we have. I think that's going to be I think that's going to be tough to duplicate, right? And there's a lot of easier models. I mean, look, the hot trend in the past few weeks, I don't know if you've discussed it on the show yet, is Redis has a new sort of open, sort of proprietary license. Who else? Mongo has a, like, well, maybe it's copyleft, but maybe it's so outrageous that it's not copyleft. You know, people are sort of trying to replicate the old shareware, freeware model. That seems to be where the energy is. And, you know, if that works for somebody, great. So if there's competition in that way, great. But we think that this model allows people to capture the best of free and open software, right? You can still iterate really quickly. You don't have to worry about licensing. It's sort of one size. It's all you can eat, instead of slicing and dicing for a thousand different contractors. So, you know, I mean, look, if somebody, like, for example, as an example of the competition we do have, I shouldn't even say competition, right? This gets back to what you were saying. You built your career out of a bunch of different sources, right? There was book income, there was, you know, public speaking, there was consulting. What we see in a lot of the folks who are signing up for us right now, they have a Patreon, they have an open collective, they have consulting. And we think, again, you know, we think in the long run, we're a better, more stable source of income because it's based on, like, actual value that you're delivering to enterprises rather than, you know, I mean, Patreon relies on the goodwill of companies, which, as we all know, the goodwill of companies is sort of fickle. If you deliver value to them that they can really quantify, that they can put into a graph and into their explanations to managers, that's going to be a steadier, larger pool of income. And so, you know, I mean, we think that those all naturally fit together.
Excellent points. Excellent points. Okay, my final two questions again, otherwise my audience will yell at me. I presume that even though you're a lawyer now, they don't keep you away from the terminal. So do you still fire up a text editor from time to time?
Well, I mean, I you said text editor and terminal, and those are two different things.
Oh, sorry.
I live in a text editor. unfortunately, it's mostly very boring text that does not go to a compiler. I do actually. I've been writing some Python lately. I bought the world's dumbest device. It is a Sony e-ink reader that shows only PDFs. Nothing at all except PDFs. And I've been writing some fun code that I hope to put on GitHub shortly, but it's not there yet, that grabs all of my news feeds once a day, converts them into a PDF, and shoots them onto this device. So instead of being constantly tempted by, oh, there's a new, you know, somebody wrote a new thing, yeah. I get it once a day. I get it on a disconnected device, sort of like an old-fashioned newspaper, right? That's been my fun project lately. Thankfully, they keep me away from the company code. That would not be a good scene.
Well, Lewis, it's been great having you come on the show and talk about Tidelift, and I'm sure you're going to be introducing this to a whole new bunch of people that you might not have heard about it yet, so that'll be great. And I'm looking forward to seeing what happens to your company over time, and hopefully I wish you the best of luck.
Great. Thank you so much, both of you, for having me on. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Great. That was Lewis Villa talking to us about, I didn't find out where he was talking to us from, and he's gone already, but I got way distracted by the fact that the show started late, so that's just the way it is. So, Jonathan, what do you think?
Oh, that's an interesting project, an interesting company that they've put together. I'm actually pretty excited about this because it is one of the best open source models that is companies and users doing support contracts and, you know, something that looks a little bit like consulting where they pay the open source projects, which I think personally, I think that is just about the best business model for open source. And it is a broker that helps small open source projects, you know, that small in that they don't have a big corporation around them, take advantage of that model without having to do, you know, miles of paperwork and you know, wading through the red tape about it. I think that's really neat. I look forward to them even more broadening their scope of the kind of projects that they've brought into this kind of collective family that they help out. Because obviously there are system libraries and projects like that that are in use in various places. You know, some of them you wouldn't ever think about, but you know, they've got mission critical uses in various places, and it is great for the projects, but it's also great for the users because they get to they have an easy way now to be able to push money back into development, kind of a simpler way for them to do it, and also sure. In return they get some of that assurance that hey, if there is a bug, so the project leader for XYZ Incorporated doesn't have to be constantly trolling the list of CVEs. They don't have to always be watching out for all of the different libraries they've got. They can just write one check, and there's this company out there that says, okay, by the way, you're using this. This is the version that we show you're using. You really need to update, and this is why. I think it's excellent. I mean, this is so long as they can keep everything together as far as the business side of it. The actual user experience side for both their customers and also the projects, I think it's just great.
Yeah, and I always look at syndications like this as having a great opportunity and usually fulfilled opportunity to use the economy of scale. You know, the individual transactions that would have to happen between, say, ZipRecruiter and Richard Hipp to use SQLite would be prohibitively expensive for if you looked at the tens of thousands of packages ZipRecruiter is using every day. Even Insight Cruises uses maybe 200 or 300 dependencies, so that would be something that would be prohibitive to try to syndicate out to negotiate out. So and in fact I forgot to ask him. I'm hoping that Richard Hipp is one of the potential Patreons of this thing, because that would be really appropriate given his contribution of SQLite to the world. But I think he's also full-time for Nokia and is pretty much paid for that way, because there's a little bit of SQLite in pretty much every smart device we own. It's something we found out by having him on a couple times before. Let's talk about who's coming up, because we're almost out of time here. We're going to lose my slot for the network. This Week in Linux is next week. We've got Michael Tunnell. Oh, started this show in early 2017. It's a news show, about a 45-minute a week, I guess, something like that. Might be a good replacement for those of you that are really hungry for things like, Dan's show, the Linux Outlaws. Might be something interesting. But we're going to bring him on to talk about his show, talk about what he does behind the scenes. Coincidence, I guess. Maybe I was thinking of that when I did last week's show. But he'll come on, and he's actually volunteered to be another of our rotating panel of co-hosts. So I want to bring him on, talk to him, see how he does talking to us. And if that's a great experience, then he'll be showing up more often as well. Invoice Ninja, right after that, a powerful suite of online tools, invoicing clients, collecting payments, creating proposals, expenses, time tasks, and more. Fully open source, including their Flutter app. So they have an app in the App Store right now. And even the source code to that, you can download and put it on your phone, which is really cool. Kong is an API gateway. It's a middleware sort of thingy. Vista is the comprehensive suite of patient care software developed by the Department of Veterans Affairs over the past 35 years. You know, that sounded really familiar, but I Googled, and we haven't had them on Floss Weekly before, but it sounded like it was familiar. Maybe we just run across them in other contexts. OpenVPN. Again, I can't believe we haven't had OpenVPN on the show in all these 11 years, but it's a free and open source software application that implements virtual private networks, right? So it's probably one of the most critical ones that everybody seems to be using. YattaDB is a new kind of database company delivering a proven database engine to your application, enhancing simplicity, security, stability, and scalability. That could be a buzzword bingo show. We'll see how that goes. Finally, rounding out the year, my buddy, well, soon to be my buddy, I guess, Eric Seidel, who works for Google, one of the chief advocates there for Flutter and has done a number of talks at a number of conferences on Flutter, is going to be coming and giving us the update. Flutter is in, well, all I can say right now, since I'm under an NDA, is it's in late preview release. So that's cool. We're hoping it gets a little further along by the time we do that show. We're hoping, crossing fingers, we'll see, presuming everything works. We also had a double book show for this week, and we'll bring them back on in January. So that was the Aon Network. And I know I talked about them a couple of times during the ending of this show, so I don't know what happened. I don't know whether they said they're canceled or I said they canceled or something, but somehow they weren't here. Well, they were all signing up to be here this week, so that's just crazy. Anyway, I guess they let anybody run this show. I'm going to be at Siegel in November as press, covering the show there. That's in Seattle. I'm also going to be at KubeCon in December, also covering that as press, also in Seattle. So that's my only plugs for coming up. Anything you want to plug, Jonathan, quickly?
Sure. So again, I'm still writing about an article a week for Hackaday. And the one for this week is When Good Software Goes Bad, Malware in Open Source, which is very interesting. It kind of is takes a parallel track with what we talked about today. So go check that out over at Hackaday.com.
Well, Jonathan, I thank you once again for stepping up for this show, especially since you had an appropriate article about it, which is really nice. and actually working with me for 2 weeks in a row. And we got really good feedback on last week's show where we went behind the scenes a little bit. So you did a great interview. So I wanted to thank you for that as well.
Yep. It's been my pleasure.
Awesome. Awesome. So that's it for this week. We'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.